welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Healing Racism in Anchorage and the University of Alaska Anchorage hosts author and activist Tim Wise. His talk, entitled Colorblind, The Rise of Post-Racial Politics and the Retreat from Racial Equity, was recorded at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage on Tuesday, September 14th.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Good evening, and welcome to Anchorage Speaks Out Against Racism, an evening with Tim Wise. My name is Ed Bourgeois. I am Director of Public Programs at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and I'm happy to serve as the Master of Ceremonies for tonight's event. I'd like to start out by thanking again the Mount Susitna Singers who welcomed you this evening. Tonight's program is only a part of an exciting list of activities occurring in Anchorage this month, thanks to the efforts of our hosts, Healing Racism in Anchorage. Healing Racism in Anchorage began in 1997 when some two dozen Anchorage residents got together to discuss what we as a community could do to eliminate the prejudice, discrimination, and racism that divide us. That meeting led to others and eventually to incorporation as a nonprofit organization. In the last 13 years, Healing Racism in Anchorage, with the support of generous individuals, agencies, and foundations, has sponsored a dozen big community-wide events like this one, and hundreds of smaller workshops and gatherings that bring our community together. The organization operates solely on donations and grants, and is run entirely by a volunteer board. And now our keynote speaker. You, the audience, will have an opportunity to ask questions and have them answered by Mr. Wise. After his speech, ushers will distribute index cards, if you missed one in the lobby, on which you can write your questions. Please complete and pass the cards to the end of your row, and the ushers will collect them for our speakers. We'll turn on the lights so you can see what you're doing. We'll have about 20 minutes for this question and answer period. Following the presentation, you'll also have an opportunity to meet Mr. Wise at a book signing to be held, guess where? In the lobby. People are always asking our speaker, Tim Wise, how a white boy from Memphis became an anti-racist activist. In his book, White Like Me, he tells us that his mother, whose people arrived in North America in colonial days, rebelled against her family's Southern ideas about race and set a model for Tim. His great-grandfather on his father's side was a Jew who fled the pogroms of Eastern Europe. His father was a stand-up comic and a writer who had no use for racism. His first job out of college was as student coordinator for a group fighting the election of David Duke, a Nazi candidate for US Senate in Louisiana. He's been fighting against racism full-time ever since. Besides a busy speaking schedule all over the United States, he regularly is featured on national television news programs, and he's written 5 books. White Like Me is an autobiography which traces how white privilege gave him little advantages throughout his life. His most recent book is called Colorblind, and he'll be discussing that tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, it is an honor to present to you Mr. Tim Wise.
Thank you. Thank you. So I cannot see you at all, which may or may not be good. It depends on how things go on any given evening. If the audience reaction is good, it's nice to see you. If the audience reaction is bad, I'd rather not. So we can keep them right where they are right now until I know that things are going well. I should point out that when people do ask me how did a white boy from Memphis get to do this work, I have to say that I have no idea because I'm from Nashville. But it's one of those errors that I should have pointed out in the bio. It's probably my fault. But the odds are that the answer to the question isn't all that different. And so here I am, and I hope to be able to add to the words of incredible wisdom that Kima offered a second ago, and I want to thank him again for doing it. Let me start out, because we have some work to do this evening and some things about which we should converse and will. But because I know that the topic of racism is not one that people come to easily, and it's not one that we like to discuss readily. For some, it is a matter of difficulty, even though I think we ought to by now have learned to speak of it. So because it is difficult, I want to start out with a story that will ease us into the conversation about the more difficult subject matter at hand. And the story doesn't have anything to do with racism. It doesn't have anything to do with oppression. It doesn't have anything to do with genocide. It doesn't have anything to do with privilege or injustice or inequality of any kind. It has to do with something that happened to me right after I got out of college. And even though the story isn't about the subject matter of the evening, it says something about that subject matter. And I think you'll know what when I'm done. You see, it's a story about how when I got out of college, I thought it would be a really great idea, for reasons that I am still not completely clear on, if I were to move into a very large house with 9 other people. Let me give you a little bit of life advice in case you are in need of it. And if you don't remember another thing I say this evening, that would be a shame, for I have more. But if you only recall one thing, you might want to take out a piece of paper and write this down. You might want to tweet it to your friends or put it on Facebook or call someone up, put it in an email, remind yourself, bookmark it. The most important thing I'll say this evening is that it is never a good idea to move into a very large house with 9 other people. It is not going to work out the way you think it is. It is not going to be as cool and fun as you might think it is going to be. The only reason I can imagine that I thought it would be okay is because, like most college students, when I got done, I was broke. And when you are broke, you will do some crazy things, like move into a very large house with 9 other people, and you don't even care if you like them. You just want to save money. You figure, I can do this for 6 months. And then it'll all be fine. I can save up my dough and then I can leave if I have to, you know. But about 6 weeks into this little experiment in communal living, I came to understand why this had been a terrible mistake, in spite of the money that we indeed did save. I mean, it was $525 a month. I don't mean per person, I mean total. I'm not good at math, but I can do that calculation. It's $5,250 a month per person. Even in 1990, that was good. So we were doing all right on that level. You had all the utility bills, everything, still less than $100 a month. But like I said, 6 weeks in, I learned the level and the gravity of the mistake. I come home from work one evening and I open the front door and I'm met by this really incredible, and I mean that in a good way, smell, which when you live with 9 other people, you cannot always assume will be the case. And so I come in, and I'm met by the smell of dinner cooking on the stove. See, we would also take turns cooking for one another, not just, you know, splitting the bills, but also splitting the cooking responsibilities. We'd like to think of this as a co-op, tried to make it political, you know, tried to make it have some type of social content. Really, it was just a big, nasty house with 10 people in it. But so this roommate of mine is making dinner for the evening on the left front burner of our stove, a big pot of gumbo, right? Because it's New Orleans. And that's what you do. Man, it smelled good. And it looked good. It even had shrimp in there. Not many, like I said, we were broke. But it had like 3 of those little bitty ass shrimp, those tiny shrimp that make popcorn shrimp look like jumbo shrimp, make jumbo shrimp look like lobsters. I know that you know what kind of shrimp I am talking about. I don't even think it is shrimp. I think it's shrimp dust, shrimp flakes, shrimp seasoning of some sort meant to give you the false impression that you're eating seafood gumbo and not as broke as you really are. But there we were, and it smelled good. My roommate asked if I wanted any, and I had to pass because I'd already had dinner that evening downtown. Didn't know that he was making this culinary feast for us. If I'd known, I would have waited. So I told him no, but I said, tell you what, please take some of it, put it in the fridge in some Tupperware, save me some. I'll take it to lunch tomorrow for, really looks good. It really smells good. He said he would do it. I said, fine. I went upstairs, did some work, hung out with some of the other roommates, watched TV, as I recall, went to bed sort of early. Got up the next morning and came downstairs to get some coffee, 7:30. Noticed that on the left front burner of that stove, still where it had been the night before, was still that pot of seafood gumbo. It did not look as good as it had 12 hours earlier. And it did not smell as good as it had 12 hours earlier. I was upset for two reasons. Number one, the food had gone to waste. He had saved no portion of it for me. Number two, he'd left the mess for me or one of the other roommates to clean. So I wasn't very happy with him, but I said, you know what? I'll just do it and I'll take it up with him later. So I grabbed the pot of gumbo. I brought it over to the sink. I got some soap and I got a scrub brush and I started to run the water. And just before I let the water go into the pot so as to clean it, I stopped myself and I said, wait a minute. I don't have to do this. This isn't my mess. I didn't make this gumbo. I didn't even eat any of this gumbo. This isn't my fault. You see, now I felt self-righteous because I talked myself out of doing the work. I took the pot of gumbo back to the left front burner of the stove, put it there for him to clean, went off to work, came back that night, 6:30, noticed that one of my other roommates was making dinner for the evening on the right front burner of the stove. But on the left front burner, right where it had been 12 and even 24 hours earlier, was the same pot of gumbo, now even nastier and more crusted to the side of the pot. I looked at my roommate and I said, what in the world are you doing? How could you make dinner for us this evening on the right front burner when I'm pretty sure you can smell the last night's dinner on the left front burner because it's right there? And he looked at me, smart guy that he was, and he said, oh, but Tim, I didn't make the gumbo. I wasn't even here for dinner last night. Were you here? Did you have any of this gumbo? I said, hey, man, not me. He said, well, neither did I. And now we both felt self-righteous because we both knew what our protestations of innocence meant. They meant that we didn't have to do the work. He looked at me and said, hey, you want some lentils and rice? And I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I would. And I ate them every bit as self-righteously as I said I wanted to. Ate the food, put the dish in the sink, cleaned it, put it in the dish drainer, went upstairs, hung out with the roommates, did some work, went to bed early, woke up the next morning, 7 a.m. I'd forgotten to set an alarm. But here's a little tip, in case you don't know this already. You probably could have figured it out, but I'll just tell you. If you're living in a house where a pot of gumbo has been sitting on the left front burner of your stove for what is now 36 and a half hours, you are not going to need an alarm clock to wake you up. Because the smell is going to crawl out of the pot of gumbo on the legs that it has grown. And I am not speaking in metaphor, English professors and English majors. I mean, literally, the stench is going to crawl on the legs that it has grown overnight. And it is going to crawl out of the pot, across the kitchen floor, across the living room, up the back stairs, go down the back hall, go under your door frame. And it is going to find, with the precision of a laser, that thing on the front of your face that you call a nose. And you're going to be awake. Now I was, and I was angry because I knew what the smell meant. I knew what was waiting for me on the left front burner of that stove, having not been cleaned by anyone, least of all the guy that made the mess. So I fling open my door. I run down the hall. I'm angry. I live with 9 other people. Can't find one of them. And the guy that made the gumbo is like Osama bin Laden. Nobody knows where in the hell he might have gone. It's like he made the gumbo as a practical joke just to see how long it would take for somebody else to clean it and then skip town. You know. I get down to the bottom of the stairs. I look across the living room into the kitchen. I see the gumbo, and 20 years later, I am here to tell you I know that the gumbo saw me. And it was at that moment, not one moment earlier, but most definitely not one moment later, that I came to understand the most important lesson I'd ever learned about anything, not just household cleanliness, anything in or out of a classroom setting. And this was the lesson. It didn't really matter anymore whether I had made the mess, did it? It didn't really matter anymore whether I was, as the old saying goes, the author of all this unpleasantness. The only thing that mattered is that I was tired of living in that funk. That I was tired of living in this nasty, increasingly toxic environment was starting to affect me. And the same is true with human societies. It's not just gumbo sitting on the left front burner of your stove, having not been cleaned. Same is true with human society. When we get tired of living in that funk, when we get tired of living in that nastiness and the residue of what somebody else did, for which we are not to blame, but the legacy of which we are inheriting nonetheless, then we will clean it not because we are guilty of having committed the problem, but because we're the only ones left to do the job. You see, there's a difference between guilt and responsibility. And if we don't know what that is, we better get clear. Guilt is what you feel because of what you've done. Responsibility is what you take because of the kind of person that you are. And so just as was the case with that house and with that gumbo, which ultimately I had to clean, we as a society have to clean up the mess of all that we have inherited, not because we did it, but because we're here. So we inherit the legacy of everything that has gone before, both the good and the bad. The problem is we as a society, we like to talk about the good. We love to live in the past. See, folks get upset when you talk about the history of indigenous genocide and you talk about the history of the enslavement of African peoples and you talk about the history of the theft of half of Mexico in a war of aggression started by this country on false pretense. When you talk about the internment of Japanese Americans and you talk about the use of virtual slave labor on the part of Chinese Americans to build the railroads that created the transcontinental economy, people say, well, you can't talk about that. That's all in the past, but now we love the past when it makes us feel good. We love the past when it venerates us and holds us up and makes us feel superior. That's what July 4th is, in case you hadn't figured that out yet. Setting off fireworks is some stuff that happened a long time ago. But no one has a problem with that. As long as it celebrates, as long as it venerates, as long as it elevates, we'll stay there, and we'll stay there a long time, and we'll demand that others do so. But if it's the bad, we want to turn away from that like history no longer matters. Or we'll deal with the bad when it's the bad done to us, or we'll linger in that perpetually. So we have folks who today, and this makes me think of it, you know, being on indigenous land, of course, everywhere I go is somebody's. Being here in Alaska and thinking about all this nonsense in New York City about folks who believe that there ought not be a Muslim cultural center, not even a mosque, not that it would matter, but a Muslim cultural center anywhere near ground zero, because that was the source of our pain, and that was the source of our injury, and that was the source of some unique terror. But I'm here to tell you, there isn't a square foot of land on this continent that isn't ground zero for someone. Not one square foot. I am from Tennessee. That is ground zero for Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creek. And Andrew Jackson's house is all of 15 to 20 minutes from mine. They take tours through that place. The architect, or one of them, of indigenous removal, but he's still a hero. And if you've got a 20 on you right now, there he is. But we don't talk about, well, you can't put a church on ground zero for Native people, because then there'd be no churches. Right? Just because the church was used to rationalize that theft and that slaughter, we don't say that that matters, because we elevate some suffering above others. That's what racism does. That's what white supremacy does. It's what the cultural supremacy that has come so far in our history does to us. And it's increasingly difficult to have this conversation, I suppose, now, because we're living in this supposedly post-racial era where all of this stuff is so passé, we ought relegate it to a history class, you know. How do we know we're living in a post-racial era? Well, isn't that obvious? We have a president of color, and that makes everything all right. Which I'm sure is what some people in Pakistan said when Benazir Bhutto, a woman, was elected. In 1988, they probably said, well, there's no more sexism in Pakistan. Patriarchy has been routed. And they said it in Great Britain when Margaret Thatcher was elected, and they said it in India when Indira Gandhi was elected, and they said it in Israel when Golda Meir was elected, and they were all wrong. Sexism wasn't defeated in those places just because a female became head of state. And by the same token, the idea that racism has been substantially eradicated or even fundamentally diminished by the election of a person of color is just as ludicrous. Let us recall that individuals, even in marginalized and oppressed groups, have always been able to succeed against the odds. That happens in every society. The first African-American millionaire in this country, who was also the first female millionaire in this country, was Madam C.J. Walker. But she became a millionaire, let's remember, in 1911, which on balance was not a real good year to be either black or a woman in this country. The fact that she could make it, though, wouldn't have led anyone in their right mind to say, well, now, if Madam C.J. Walker can make it, what's wrong with all the rest of y'all? You know, you just need to work harder. We would have seen that individual success does not translate to systemic transformation. It might down the line, but in and of itself, it doesn't tell us very much. What's the reality that we're dealing with rather than the rhetoric? The reality is that although this economic downturn is affecting virtually everyone, it is still doing as it always does, and as is true in good times or bad, hitting persons of color substantially harder than it is even those white folks who I know are being hammered by it. And I don't mean to diminish the injury and the harm that's being experienced by white folks. I'll have more to say about that and its connection to racism in just a second. But let us recall that according to Labor Department data right now, even people of color with college degrees, who've done everything right, they stayed in school, they listened to those commercials, you know, the ones with the shooting star that shoots across the screen. It says, the more you know. They did everything they were supposed to do. And yet they are still twice as likely, almost twice as likely, to be out of work as their white counterparts with the same education. We know that the wealth disparities in our country, in part because of the history of past oppression, but also the fact that wealth tends to be accumulate in an exponential fashion. So whereas income disparities have diminished a little bit, that's the good news, you know, between white folks and people of color. I do mean a little bit, not a lot, but a little. Wealth disparities have actually gotten worse, because if prior generations of white Americans had access to accumulate stuff and people of color by and large didn't, then those folks hand that stuff down to a new generation, and the ability to have that accumulate in a much more, you know, dramatic fashion than income accumulates has been seen. And so right now the average white family in the country has about 12 times the net worth of the average Black family, 8 times the net worth of the average Latino family, and the ratio between white and indigenous families is virtually incalculable because, on average, indigenous net worth is negative. So it is an infinite ratio. So you can't even really calculate it. It's so large. In spite of land settlements, in spite of all of that, doesn't change the fundamental wealth gaps and disparities that exist between the white dominant majority and peoples of color. It's not because we worked harder. It's not because we prayed harder. God knows it isn't because we were necessarily more ethical or had some superior investment strategy that people of color were lacking. I mean, if we've learned nothing in the last 2 years of global economic meltdown, let us at least take this away, that a handful of very rich white men are capable of losing a lot of money without any help from Black people, without any help from Mexicans, without any help from Native people, without any help from people of color, just all on our own. And all of it before Barack Obama ever walked into his new house. You know. So that's the reality. What else is the reality? Nationwide study not too long ago found at about 1.2 million instances of blatant racial discrimination in the employment sector, in the labor market, take place every year against people of color, depriving those persons of color of hundreds of millions of dollars potentially in income and over time accumulated wealth, that there are between 2 and 3 million instances a year of housing discrimination against people of color, given worse loan terms, for instance, than would have been the case had they been white, with the same credit history, with the same income, with the same collateral, et cetera. That's what's going on in the country, and that's going on in 2010. That's going on in the age of Obama, so to speak, not merely something 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years ago, although I should point out, because when we talk about our denial of this problem, we need to understand that it goes back 30 and 40 and 50 and 150 years. We'd like to think, perhaps, that denial is new, you know, that young people look around and they see these outward manifestations of progress, some of which is just symbolic, some of which is real, but which makes them think that we've come further than we have. Well, that's part of it. But the reality is that denial by the white majority has been an intergenerational phenomenon. It isn't new. So you can go back to the early 1960s and see the same thing, even when we were a formal system of white supremacy by law, before the Civil Rights Act, before the Voting Rights Act, before the Fair Housing Act. You can go back to 1963, for instance, right? The year of the March on Washington, and by that I mean the real one, not the fake one of a few weeks ago. And you can look at what happened when the Gallup organization asked white Americans, do you believe, now of course, they only asked the question about black folks at that time, because pollsters and researchers were so oblivious to the injury done to indigenous people. It was as if indigenous people weren't even in the picture at all to researchers, you know, and to Census Bureau, Labor Department. I mean, that's how pathetic, right, the research has been, and how invisible indigenous people have been made in the history and in the culture. But 1963, they asked black folks, this is the height of the civil rights struggle. They asked white folks, excuse me, at the height of the civil rights struggle, whether or not those whites believed that black folks had equal opportunity in America and were treated equally in their communities in housing and employment and education. And in 1963, right, the year of the March on Washington, which was obviously rooted in the notion that the answer to that question was no, right? Two out of three white Americans in 1963 said, of course, there's equal treatment. What? Racism? What? Apartheid? What? White supremacy? What? Are you kidding? What are you talking about? And that means, I mean, just envision this for a minute. Think about the picture this conjures. This means in 1963, August 28th, March on Washington, Dr. King gives the I Have a Dream speech. Two out of three white folks who turn on the news that night and are watching the clip from the speech, two out of three white folks are basically looking at the screen going, I don't get it. Why are you angry? Why are you marching? Dream? What? Why are you dreaming? I don't get it. Everything's fine here in America. Could we turn Leave It to Beaver back on so I don't have to deal with this? Could we go back into our bubble of denial, please? And in 1962, even a year earlier, right, 87%, almost 9 out of 10 whites told Gallup that we believe that black children had equal educational opportunity in America. 87% thought that in 1962. Now, here's the deep thing. In retrospect, we can see that's borderline delusional. In retrospect, we can say, my God, how is that possible? But now here's the really heavy lesson. Was that because two out of three white folks in 1963 or 87% of white folks in 1962 were just uncaring, horrible, hateful, mean, nasty, evil, vicious people who just didn't care? Is it because they were just too stupid, somehow damaged to be able to tell reality from fiction? No, I think for most it wasn't. For some, of course, good Lord, yes, there were people like that, right? But to believe that that's why nearly 9 out of 10 white folks couldn't see it, not very likely. To think that's why 2 out of 3 white folks didn't see it in 1963, not very likely. What's more likely than that, and as a result, it's actually more frightening than the answer that white folks were just evil, you know? That would make it easier, in a way. The scarier reality is that 2 out of 3 white folks in 63, or 87% in 62, didn't know better because we didn't have to. Because to be white in 63, to be white in 1863, to be white in 1763, to be white right now in 2010 is not to have to know what people of color experience. Because if I don't know what people of color experience, what happens to me? Nothing. It's not going to be on the test. By that, I mean whatever test you got to take to get into college, to get out of college, to get any job in this country, to practice law, to practice medicine, to be a social worker, to do just about anything. They're not going to make you demonstrate that you're competent with regard to the lived experience of peoples of color if you're white. But if people of color don't learn the stuff we think is important, oh, all hell will break loose, because that's going to be on the test. In fact, that's going to be the test. Right. This is why, for those who were still not quite clear on this, this is why we don't have White History Month. Because in case you've missed it, we have several. They just go by the tricky names that we've given them, like May and June and July and August. When your stuff is the stuff that is considered normal, you don't have to racially designate where it came from. You don't have to call it, you know, white literature. You can just call it literature. You don't have to call it white poetry. It's just poetry, theater, art. That's the privilege of being in the dominant group. You don't have to think of your stuff as culturally specific. You just think of it as universal, to the detriment of all those who have to know better than that. And so that's the history of that denial. It's a long-standing phenomenon. If you don't have to know something, the odds are you won't know it, even though you're a good person. That's the sick little secret. Most people are good, white, black, brown, doesn't matter. Most people are decent people, right? But decent people who don't have to know something probably won't know it. And then because they are behind that veil of ignorance and innocence, and I use that word only in the most cynical of ways, we won't likely know. It's the same reason that for those of us in this room who are able-bodied, we probably didn't pay much attention to how we got in this building tonight. Because we didn't have to, did we? For those of us who were able-bodied, and I should say temporarily so, because if we live long enough, all of us will eventually experience some form of disability or infirmity in all likelihood. But those of us who are temporarily able-bodied, we have the luxury. Were there steps? I didn't pay attention. Is there a ramp? I didn't notice. Was the door wide enough for me to be able to move through? Well, I don't have a chair, so it didn't concern me. Was I able to get from that side of the stage to here? If there's a fire, God forbid, will I be able to get out? These are all the things that as a temporarily able-bodied person, I do not have to concern myself with, and yet which anyone who is disabled will have to contend with as a matter of survival and getting through an average and typical day. That is a real privilege to not have to sweat that. You see, it's true of every identity. It's true of race, and it's true of gender, and it's true of sexuality, and it's true of class, and it's true of disability. That's all I'm saying is that when you have the luxury of obliviousness, you're a dangerous person. Because when you have the luxury of obliviousness, the odds that you will recreate injustice become far greater. And when we're trying so hard as we seem to be colorblind, to downplay race, we get into trouble. You can't solve a race-specific injury by being blind to the thing that's bringing it about. You can't solve a color-based discrimination by being colorblind. It's like Julian Bond says, to be blind to color is to be blind to the consequence of color. If color has consequences and we're not noticing or talking about the thing that's bringing that consequence about, how do we solve that problem? We don't. In fact, we make it worse. How does colorblindness make it worse? Very simply. You see, and I started thinking about this as a dad. I have a 7 and a 9-year-old. And when you have little kids, you think about how they learn stuff. You know, what's their process of developing wisdom and knowledge about various things? And for me, my concern was, you know, thinking about race and inequalities of various types. And I was thinking about this, and I realized one of the biggest dangers in this society, in our culture, is we're all raised, we're all taught differently by our parents. We all come up with some different families and different stuff. But there's one thing that pretty much everybody who has any real exposure to dominant culture in our country is absolutely exposed to all the time. It's like a secular gospel. It is the overriding mantra and cultural belief, social, political, and economic belief of our society. It's this idea that if you just work hard, you'll make it. If you didn't make it, it's because you didn't work hard enough. It's all about you. It's all about rugged individualism. So if you made it, it's because you were the best. If you didn't, it's because you didn't try hard enough. Now, in and of itself, that belief is not racist, and it's not sexist, and it's not classist. But the conclusions that you will reach in a society that teaches you that will, in fact, be racist and sexist and classist, as long as there are vast disparities in outcome between different groups. Because if I'm led to believe that where I end up is all about my own effort and where you end up is all about yours, and then I look around and I can see by the age of 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, I don't have to be a sociologist. I don't have to be an anthropologist. I just have to be awake, and I can look around and I can see the disparity in resources with my own eyes. And if you tell me that that disparity is the result of merit, what is my conclusion? The conclusion is that those people at the bottom deserve what they got. They are inferior, be it biological, genetic, or cultural, and those of us at the top are superior based on the same things, and by God, that's just, I guess, okay. And so colorblindness, by removing the context that would allow us to understand the disparities that we see, leaves us then with one only conclusion. And it's a conclusion that is inevitably going to lead to more bias, to more prejudice, to more racist and sexist and classist conclusions. And that is that conclusion that it's all natural and normal and maybe the result of inherent superiority or inferiority. You see, when little kids don't have answers to why things happen, they make them up. They fill in their own blanks, and they will fill them in with conclusions that make sense to them. We can't afford to strip from our children's eyes the context of all the things that they see. I know it's not an easy conversation to have with our youngsters, but we must. We also have to be color conscious, not only so we can check racism in others, but also in ourselves, check our own biases. We don't like to acknowledge that this is a problem that we have. We like to point to others. Oh, I'm not racist. Oh, my Uncle Jim, now he's terrible. You know. Oh, my Aunt Betty. Oh, you don't want to be around Betty. Oh, my goodness, no. But me, no, not me, no. No, I have black friends. I dated an Asian woman once. I have a dream catcher in my rearview mirror, and that makes me think that I'm indigenous. No. So I'm not racist, but the research on this is really quite overwhelming, you know, that the vast majority of us have subconscious, if not conscious, implicit, if not explicit, bias against non-dominant groups, be they non-dominant religious, non-dominant racial, non-dominant gender, non-dominant sexuality, non-dominant physical ability or disability. Anytime we talk about marginalized groups, about 80%, according to the research, have those implicit biases. And the other 20% probably got lucky when they took the test, you know? Probably had some of it too. It might just not have come out. I mean, there was one study that found, for instance, that when asked just the question, do you think that Native peoples are, you know, more inherently American than any other group? Everybody knows that's the right thing to say, you know. So 70% of whites, when they were asked that, they said, oh, yes, Native peoples, absolutely. Indigenous peoples are more American than any of us, absolutely. They're the first America, absolutely. And then they take the implicit bias test where they show faces of people, flash them really quickly, right? Don't give you a lot of time to think about it. Then they pair it with certain words. So they show you a face of a white person, they pair it with the word American. Or they show you a face of a Native person, they pair it with the word American. And they're waiting to see how quickly you hit the button that shows that you associate the word with the picture. And what do you know? We hit the button far quicker when it's the white face paired with the word American. Why? Because implicitly, our subconscious mind can, our conscious mind can say, because it sounds good, Native people are more American than any, but internally, we've got a whole different process going on. No, we're the prototypical American. That's what our brains inside are telling us, you see. That's the implicit bias that we have to deal with. It doesn't make us bad people. Doesn't mean that we're deliberately lying when we say that we are not racist. It means that we often don't know of what we're really made, you know? We don't understand the way conditioning works, but advertising works, doesn't it? I mean, that's why those corporations spend billions of dollars to sell you toothpaste and toilet paper and hamburgers at midnight that you can't even go buy if you wanted to at midnight because the place is closed. But they show you the advertisement because they need to get in your head that that's the toilet paper, that's the toothpaste, that's the hamburger that you absolutely must have. And eventually, you'll see enough of their ads that you'll think to yourself, brand loyalty, I need that. If advertisers can make us do that with toilet paper and toothpaste and hamburgers at 12 midnight, trust me when I tell you that if we're conditioned by racial stereotypes, gender stereotypes, class stereotypes, ability stereotypes, all these other stereotypes year after year from the time we're quite young, that's going to take also, you know? But here's the final point, and then I'll take the questions. Worst part of all of this is that if we're not willing to stare racism in the face and racial inequality in the face, we're all going to pay a price for that. It's not just an issue for people of color, right? It's not just they who are going to be hurt. Oh, they're the targets of it, make no mistake. But we as white folks are the collateral damage of it, and we ought not forget that. And here's what I mean. One of the most obvious ways in which racism manifests in the modern era, as opposed to in previous years, is it's not always acts of commission, things that we do to others, although sometimes that's part of it, make no mistake. A lot of times it's a sin of omission, things we just don't do. Instead of active hatred or contempt, it's indifference. Indifference to suffering. That's why people turned on those who survived Katrina and the aftermath of Katrina so quickly. It was indifference to their suffering. It was the belief that somehow they deserved their fate. So we were indifferent. We didn't necessarily want that to happen to them, but when it did, we only were sympathetic for about a week. And then we turned on them. Indifference, a new and modern form of racism. But here's the danger of that indifference, right? Think about the housing meltdown right now. Folks having their houses foreclosed on. A lot of those folks, middle class, a lot of those folks, white. Now, here's what's interesting about this. 15, 16 years ago was the first time I ever read anything about the subprime mortgage problem. I remember reading a book then, and it was talking about how these mortgage lenders, usually not banks, because banks are regulated. There are certain rules about how they can lend and what they're able to do. They still do some subprime lending, but not nearly as much. It was really these independent mortgage brokers, non-regulated for the most part by the state, able to go in to communities and rip them off and charge outrageous interest, far more than they would have been charged had a regular bank been willing to give them the loan. So I read this book back in like 1993, and there were almost no congresspersons in either party, almost no one in the media that wanted to pay any attention to this. You know, it was just, they were ripping off poor folks. They were almost all of color. There were some organizations, nonprofit groups, community organizing groups that tried to make folks pay attention, and no one really cared. The attitude seemed to be, well, it's not my problem. It's not my neighborhood, you know. I don't know any of those people, and if they're stupid enough to get in over their head, then they deserve whatever happens to them. I shouldn't have to bail them out if they made a bad investment. That theory works really well when the only folks who are foreclosed on are like miles away from when you live. But here we are, 16, 17, 15, whatever it is, years later. And now that problem that used to be in someone else's neighborhood, so we didn't care, now it's spread because what did those mortgage lenders do? They said, well, if they're not going to stop us from ripping folks off, if they're not going to regulate our industry, we're going to go into the suburbs and we're going to go into the exurbs, which is the ring beyond the suburbs. When you aren't far enough out of the city, you got to move even further. That's the exurb. Or they went into the small towns. They went into villages. They went in all over the country and started giving out the same kind of lousy loans to a lot of folks who weren't people of color, and they weren't always poor. A lot of them were middle class. Some of the communities being hit hardest right now by the housing meltdown are actually were solidly middle class communities, overwhelmingly white. Now all of a sudden folks are realizing maybe they should have paid attention. Maybe they should have been a bit more empathic. Maybe they should have been a bit more concerned, because that idea that I don't care if you got in over your head, it's your fault. Yeah, but now if you're the only one on your block whose house isn't being foreclosed on, how do you feel about that now? Try to sell your house when all the houses around you are being foreclosed on. Good luck, your property value just went into the toilet, you see? So maybe that indifference, maybe that attitude that says they get what they deserve, maybe the bias that leads us to not care when it's only someone else that's being hurt comes back to haunt us. Oh, it doesn't do it right away, but eventually it does. And trust me when I tell you and give you this as a cautionary tale. That story was about how we ignored something for so many years, but this is a cautionary tale. 35 years from now, make no mistake about it, write it down if you don't already know, this is a fact and it will not change whether you like it or don't like it. In 35 to 40 years from this evening, at least half, if not more than half, of the population of the United States will be people of color. It is a fact. Now, if we are going to maintain a healthy society, one in which we have any hope of economic opportunity for anyone, one in which the political, social, or economic systems work for anyone beyond maybe a very narrow bunch that can afford to live behind gates and hire their own cops, if it's going to work for anybody else, you better ask yourself, how does that possibly happen? How does that possibly work? How is it possibly sustainable in 30 or 35 years if half the population, that which is people of color, has twice the unemployment on average, three times the poverty rate on average of the other half, which is white? How do we sustain a healthy society in 35 or 40 years if half the population, that of color, has on average 9 to 12 years less life expectancy than the other half, which is white? How do we maintain a healthy society if the half that are people of color have at best maybe one-tenth the net worth of the other half that is white, twice the rate of infant mortality as the other half that is white? Four, five, six times the incarceration rates of the other half that is white. How in the world do we maintain a healthy society for anybody in that kind of setting? I have news for you. The answer is that we do not. And so whether or not we are the ones being touched right now by racial disparity and racial inequity, whether or not we as individuals may agree or disagree with the particular solutions that we must look to do something about that disparity, make no mistake, you better sweat this. And you better think about it. You better be willing to lose sleep over it, because if you don't, we will pass down that problem to our children if we're lucky enough to have them, to our grandchildren if we are one day or already lucky enough to have them, and then they will get to clean up the gumbo that we did not clean. We will have passed the problem down, and in the process, we will have cursed them for yet another generation, and it is time to break that curse and to begin by doing it tonight. Thank you all so much for being here, and I appreciate your time.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with author and activist Tim Wise. He was recorded speaking at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage on September 14th. Following his talk entitled Colorblind, The Rise of Post-Racial Politics and the Retreat from Racial Equity, Tim Wise responded to questions from audience members.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So if anyone else that didn't fill out a card has a burning question, you can raise your hand. These ushers are bringing the cards to us. And if you haven't had a chance and you've thought of something you'd like to ask, just raise your hand and we'll get a card to you and just quickly fill them out and pass them back to the end of the rows.
Great.
How would you start the conversation about racism? The first eye-opening for a group of mostly white high schoolers. What are the first important steps to becoming anti-racist?
I think conversations are best in those kinds of settings, not big speeches like this, but especially one-on-one or in smaller groups, and particularly with young folks that are high school or younger, is if you start with personal stories, and if you start with your own personal experience with issues of race and racism, either witnessing it, sometimes even having fallen prey to it yourself, talking honestly about that. My experience has been if you want to get folks to address their own biases, it helps to talk about your own. If you want to get folks to address their privileges, whether they're racial privileges, class privileges, gender privileges, any other form, it's best to talk about your own, because no one wants, understandably, to think that the person who's doing the workshop or speaking to them is looking down on them. So if you own your stuff, other people will be more likely to own theirs. And I think that's how you begin these dialogues, and it's how you sustain them. The most important lessons to learn are fundamentally that when you're in the dominant group, and again, not just racial, for men this is true, for those with money it's true, for able-bodied people it's true, for heterosexual folks it's true, that the biggest thing to learn is that there's an awful lot we don't know, and that we don't know it precisely because we are the dominant group and have not had to learn it. And thus, if we are asking the question, is racism a problem? Is sexism a problem? Is classism a problem? Is straight supremacy a problem? All of these things. The only logical thing to do is to listen to those who have to know the answers to those questions, who are of color, and they are women, and they are poor and working class, and they are LGBT. And when they tell us that they are problems, we listen and we believe them and don't think that they're crazy. That's the first lesson.
Why has decolonization been so unproductive?
Well, because we haven't really had decolonization in many ways. We've tried, ostensibly, though one could argue how much. You know, colonization has been of two things. And one is land and peoples. And the other thing that we've colonized are minds and ideas and our brains and the territory between our ears, which is oftentimes a more important target for those who are attempting to colonize than even the land on which they live. And so during a long anti-colonial struggle, which of course in this country has gone on for hundreds of years on the part of indigenous peoples, all around the world those struggles have gone on against colonial powers and those who have sought to colonize and to extirpate and to eradicate other people. But the process has never been complete, because we have never really taken seriously the need to undermine the distribution and to fundamentally alter the distribution of stuff that was the result of colonization. We put Band-Aids on the injury after the fact. We come up with small amounts of money and occasionally land, and we have semi-sovereignty for indigenous people. I say semi because, of course, the state and the government of the United States still exercises an inordinate amount of influence despite the supposedly sovereign arrangements that it has with indigenous peoples, but fundamentally the distribution of stuff is as it has been. And the colonization of the mind, which goes pretty much unchecked in our school system, allows us to continue to say, well, we're going to celebrate the diversity, let's say, of indigenous peoples, and we're going to learn their customs, and we're going to learn their traditions, and we're going to really celebrate those, maybe. We don't even do that sometimes, but that's like the best of it, you know? But at the end of the day, we're going to maintain the dominant tradition as being superior. We're going to learn about your stuff, but we're going to maintain the dominance of our stuff, you know? And so the colonization hasn't really been checked. and the way in which indigenous peoples have been affected by that. It's so vast. I mean, I don't even have the time to go into it. I would recommend, and I've done it a few times since I've been here, a fantastic book was written several years ago by Roberto and Bonnie Duran, who are indigenous scholars in the lower 48, who wrote a book called Native American Postcolonial Psychology. And it is a very in-depth examination of how therapists and psychologists and counselors and social workers who are working with indigenous peoples have to understand what they identify as the soul wound of colonization, right? That the wound is not just physical, it's not just material, it is spiritual and a soul wound. It is a long-standing history of conquest and genocide that one brings into the present because one has historical memory that when you're marginalized, makes a lot of sense. When you're the dominant group, we don't think of history that way. You know, the past is the past, and the present is the present, and the future is the future. And that's a very Eurocentric and a very dominant group way of looking at time and history and the passage of both. So we have to really reshape the way that we do our schooling and reshape the way that we do counseling and reshape the way that we do the provision of healthcare and really understand that as long as those things are still following a dominant model, we haven't had decolonization to any real fundamental extent.
We have the awareness of racism now. We have the awareness of racism. Now, how do we keep it at the forefront of the work we do? It seems easy to slip back into the complacent, silent, and passive role of seeing racism every day but not doing anything about it.
Well, that's very true. I think that the way that I keep it in the forefront of my mind and have for 20 years, even before I was out on the lecture circuit and before there was any sort of career or professional responsibility behind it. When I was a community organizer in public housing in the city of New Orleans, when I was doing grassroots work in the city of New Orleans, the thing that I always came back to that made it impossible for me to burn out or to walk away from it, which is easy to do, this is heavy stuff, and it's very easy for anyone, especially when they're a dominant group member and they don't feel that they have to do this as if their life depends on it, to say, wow, this is really tough. I think I'm going to do something else for a while. But the thing that brings me back and always did was a recognition, really two things. Number one, that there were far better than I, far braver than I, who had gone before me and who had paid the ultimate price for speaking out against injustice. And they did it in a much worse time and a much harder time and a much harder place. As difficult as it is now, it was more so for our ancestors and for those who fought against even worse odds. And so in that regard, it would be fundamentally disrespectful to their memory, to those who have struggled and died over so long to beat back white supremacy and exploitation and economic injustice and colonialism, to just sort of say, wow, this is tough, The second thing was a realization that it was affecting me. When I came to see the harm that white supremacy was doing to me, and when it no longer was about I'm doing it for people of color. I'm doing it for them. I'm doing it for this sort of missionary ideal, this idea that, I have to be the savior of other people. If that's why any white person is involved in the struggle against racism, we need desperately to find another hobby. The truth is, peoples of color will, I believe, at the end of the day, will ultimately liberate themselves from white supremacy. Now, maybe easier with the help of white allies, I don't know for sure, but with or without us, they're going to do what they got to do. The question for me became, who's going to liberate us from white supremacy? Because when I worked in the campaigns against David Duke in 90 and 91 in Louisiana, and for those who don't know who that is, lifelong, at least his adult life, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, that's not even fair because neo-Nazi would suggest that David had thought of something new. And in fact, he's sort of an old school, I think that would make him Paleolithic Nazi or Jurassic Nazi. But here was a guy, and I don't use that term lightly, I'm Jewish, I sort of reserve Nazi for those who deserve it, But David, former head of the largest Klan group, overt racist, overt white supremacist, running for US Senate and governor, and I was involved in the campaigns against him, and ultimately he lost. But if you don't remember, it's been 19 and 20 years ago, he did get, in the Senate race, 60% of the white vote, and in the governor's race, 55% of the white vote, which is to say that the majority of people who sign the census form the way I do voted for a Nazi. They didn't sign the Jewish part like I do. I don't think any of my people in that regard probably voted for the Nazi. But the white part, 6 out of 10, voted for him. And it wasn't because they didn't know he was a Nazi. Nobody didn't know that he was a Nazi. Everybody knew, and they still pulled the lever. They still looked at it, and they said, you know, yeah, he's a Nazi. But I like his stand on term limits, so what the hell? You know? But the thing that woke me up, I mean, I remember sitting up after that election, and I couldn't celebrate, even though we'd won, because I realized we'd lost so much more, you know? And I came to realize that, you know, black folks saved us in Louisiana, and they went out and stopped him. We weren't. We were going to vote him in. Black folks were like, all right, y'all are crazy. We will just have to go and do this. You can thank us later. We'll take care of it, because y'all have lost your mind. And it came a point where I realized at some point, white folks have to stop asking people of color to bail us out, whether it's in the Civil War, which wouldn't have been won by the Union but for the addition of troops of color, whether it's the Revolution itself, which wouldn't have been possible without the money made off the back of tobacco and later the cotton economy, which was dependent on enslaved labor. Once again, folks of color can't always be the ones. You know, at some point we have to stand up and say, no, no, that's our job because that's our people and I'm not that much better than them. I'm not any more moral or ethical than those 6 out of 10 white folks that voted for Duke. You know, the only difference between myself and those individuals is I had some experiences growing up that they didn't and it sent me down this road. And they had some that I didn't along the way and it sent them down that road. And as long as that's the case, I can't be smug. I can't even judge them. I just have to work with them, and it isn't always easy, but that's the work. And when I think of it that way, and I realize what white supremacy is capable of doing to us, to twist us, to take us away from who we were meant to be in this very short time that we get to even be here on this earth and be anything at all, I came to realize that we had an obligation to do it, not for others, but for ourselves, and that keeps your head in the game because you can't walk away from that. That's your life on the line, you know? So there you go.
Could you speak to the way in which we in the United States are wildly overproducing carbon and the fact that that's as racist in its own way as an institution like slavery? The effects of climate disruption caused by our fossil fuel use will so disproportionately impact people of color worldwide.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good point, and I'm glad to see the climate issue framed in that way because a lot of times climate activists, and this is true of the larger sort of movement for ecological sanity, ignores that element, you know, and looks at it only as an ecological issue in terms of the globe itself and the planet and whether or not the polar ice caps will melt and all of these things. And all of those things are very legitimate, but let's understand that right now, as the question suggests, there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people at risk for extreme weather events because of climate change that are overwhelmingly poor and of color around the world. That the continent of Africa right now is losing something in the neighborhood of $60 billion in potential agricultural product because of the effects on crops of climate change, right? So that's having a very specific effect, again, in this case, on peoples of color. That in our own country, the way that greenhouse gas emissions trap heat result in these heat islands, particularly in urban areas where a disproportionate number of people of color live, which then contributes not only to all kinds of health emergencies, but an increase in, you know, the smog problem, which then continues to affect respiratory disease and all kinds of things. I mean, over and over and over and over again, the effect of these things to which we as a nation are contributing more than our fair share, to be sure, is indeed, I think, racist in effect and culturally and racially supremacist. I should also point out that the mentality of resource exploitation that undergirds that and the mentality of resource extraction that says we have the entitlement to those things. We are entitled to the things in the ground that we have found that we think we need for our way of life, and we have the entitlement to those things. That's a mentality that goes way beyond just capitalism as an economic system. That is a mentality that says, these are our resources. If they're under your land, that's your problem. How did our oil get under your land anyway? So the idea that we're entitled to those and that people will say, well, we have to maintain our way of life. That is a fascinating statement on the mentality of entitlement that says, no matter the cost, we have a right to this. That is a worldview that, although there are other cultures in history that have manifested similar worldviews, never has it reached this apex, never has it reached this zenith as it has in the white West. And so I think not only is the climate change on the end result racist in effect, I think the very mentality that undergirds militarism and resource exploitation around the globe and sends us all around the globe really in search of these resources for extraction and our use is culturally supremacist as well, whether we're really wanting to hear that or not. And I know we're not, but I think it's true. Thank you all so much for being here and for the fantastic questions. Thank you.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage with Tim Wise. Healing Racism in Anchorage and UAA hosted Tim Wise, author of White Like Me and Between Barack and a Hard Place, at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage. His talk, entitled Colorblind, The Rise of Post-Racial Politics and the Retreat from Racial Equity, was based on his most recent book title and recorded on September 14th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.